Hello and welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That guy over there, that's Tim Dennis. Hey, Tim.
Hey.
Listen, we've got a lot of cool stuff to talk about on today's program. This book came across my desk, the information I wanted to make sure we got him on, and got her on, rather, to talk about the book, the story, the history, because, you know, above all, I'm fascinated by the parts of history we're not always filled in about. And that's been a big facet of my interest in doing the Holzer Files TV show, is getting to go behind the story and dig a little deeper. And I knew, Tim, with your fascination with history as well, this book was going to fit right into our roundhouse for our audience. And, you know, what better time to play it than here on Christmas, Tim?
Mm-hmm.
It's our little Christmas gift to you of strange supernatural ilk. The book is called A Demon Haunted Land, Witches, Wonder Doctors, and the Ghosts of the Past in Post-World War II Germany. Our guest this evening, Monica Black, is with us to discuss this. She is a professor of history at the University of Tennessee and the author of Death in Berlin. She's won the prestigious Frankel Prize, among other awards. She lives in Knoxville, Tennessee. She's here to talk with us. And you know what? When I get blurbs about books, sometimes you've got to dig deeply to kind of get a concept of what we're about to engage in. And I love that going on Amazon, which we have a link for that book in today's program guide, folks, so you can find it real easy. I love that it starts off with this splash, Tim. A revelatory counter-history of post-war Germany, not as a reborn democracy, but as a nation convulsed by apocalyptic visions, witchcraft trials, and supernatural obsessions. Everything about that spoke to our program. So I knew I had to reach out and invite Monica Black to be our guest. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, I'm so delighted to be here. Thank you so much for having me on your program. I'm excited to talk to you about the book.
You know, we've talked through the years about the witches' involvement in World War II, allegedly, and the supernatural vibe. And obviously, anybody that's ever watched an Indiana Jones movie knows that there was a fascination by the Nazi Party to acquire supernatural artifacts, anything to give them an edge. And a lot of times we've discussed that on the show. What's fact? What's fiction? I had no clue that the rest of this history fleshed out after World War II. So let's start. I mean, how did this come to your attention? And what made you decide, you know, this is a part of our history we need to talk about?
Well, it came to my attention when I was doing research. I was sitting in a library, the state library in Berlin, and I was, I don't remember exactly where I saw the reference then, but I ran across a reference to a book written by a man named Johann Kruse, about whom I would learn quite a bit more over the years. A very fascinating person. He wrote a book called Are There Witches Among Us? It was published in 1951. And I thought to myself, well, that can't really be about witches. It must be something else. Maybe it's satire. Maybe it's a metaphor for something else. I didn't know. And so I asked for the book to be pulled out of the stacks. And I started reading it. And I learned that, in fact, it was about witches. It was about, I should say that a little bit differently. It was about beliefs that people had in Germany after the war that some of their neighbors were witches. So it was about witchcraft fears. And this gentleman who wrote the book, Johann Kruse, he was very alarmed by this issue. He was very alarmed by the social implications of people accusing their neighbors of being witches. And it was something actually that as I began to do research about him and read a book that had been published about him in the 1980s, he had been telling people that this was a problem, neighbors accusing neighbors of being witches, for a long time. He had been talking about it and writing about it and publishing about it since the 1920s. And I think mostly people ignored him. But after the war, he gained a significant fame in the years following the Second World War, in the 1950s in particular. He became a kind of go-to guy on the subject of witchcraft fears. And that was really how I got started, was finding out about him and finding out about his publications, and then starting to read more and connect more dots over time.
You know, it's interesting in visiting with a few of the big movie studios here last year and doing some of the tours. It was interesting to hear that monster movies really kind of hit during times of depression or war. And here you've got Germany post-war and witchcraft starts being bandied about. Why do you think there's this strange connective tissue to something so horrific as the war, to, you know, suddenly this belief or thought that you've got witches living next door, or you're dealing with these aspects of the supernatural?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the case of post-war Germany, the argument that I make in the book and the way that I explain this in the book has to do with the, you know, sort of after effects of a very incomplete denazification process. So what I mean by that, just for people who, just to kind of fill in a little bit of the background, you know, after the war, the Allies occupied Germany, and it was divided into four zones, and three of these zones eventually became West Germany, which is the place that, you know, the story that I'm telling takes place. And then the Soviet occupied zone became what was then called East Germany. And in West Germany after the war, particularly in small face-to-face communities, and I think that's a very important part of the story, there were a lot of unresolved grievances after the war about what people had done during the war, about who had been on which side politically and issues like that. But as I said, because the denazification process, that is the process of sort of weeding out Nazis from important government positions, or weeding them out of teaching positions, or weeding them out of the medical profession or the legal profession, because this process was incomplete, and because in a certain way, and I think we can all kind of understand this, in a certain way, after a certain period of time after 1945, during which people discussed very openly Germany's responsibility for the war and for the Holocaust, after a certain period of time, that conversation kind of ends. It ends pretty sharply, actually, as the Cold War begins to escalate. So as the Americans and the Soviets sort of marshal their relationships with these new emerging German states in the climate of the Cold War, the desire to sort of discuss the recent past and what had happened and the crimes of the Third Reich, that desire diminishes considerably. And the way that I explain in my book, the way that I explain this kind of spike in witchcraft accusations has to do with my sense that witchcraft accusations were a form of they were a way in which people worked through social conflict in a kind of sublimated way. So people are not saying to each other exactly what they might want to say, but they are suspicious of each other. They don't know who's telling whom what. There, you know, the possibility that someone knows something about someone and might share what he knows. All of these sorts of these fears very much mark the post-war era, the immediate post-war era. And I think that witchcraft beliefs, which already existed in some form in Germany before the period that I'm describing, they become the way, in a sense, that people work out some of these grievances. So that's the argument that I make in my book.
Do they start to lean on this dark cloud as kind of a, we need to have a boogeyman, we need to have a place to put our fears, our concerns, so let's place it in something supernatural, something that we all agree probably exists or might exist, but that is unattainable. We can't really wrap our hands around it and throw it out. And then, you know, we can have our evil and feel vindicated or validated as well.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it raises the question that you're asking. And I think it's a really interesting question. I think the way that I think what you're saying raises the question of, do people sort of need to have, enemies, or do they need to scapegoat each other? I'd like to think that we don't, that that's not like an anthropological constant of human beings. But I do think that in the aftermath of the war, there were ways that talking about your neighbor being a witch, or suspecting that your neighbors were in league with evil and were working in secret, conspiring against you, was an explanation for all kinds of other things that seemed otherwise inexplicable. So, you know, witchcraft accusations often erupt in various contexts, not only historically, but also in various parts of the world. When they do erupt, they often do so in response to multiple misfortunes. So, you know, I can have there can be a storm in my town or something like that, or in my, you know, in my environs, there could be a hurricane or something like that, a big storm that knocks a tree over, let's say. And I know that the tree was knocked over by the wind, say, but there's a higher order question behind the question of how the tree fell on my house, let's say. So if a tree is knocked over by the wind because of a storm and it falls on my house, on the one hand, I know very well that the wind caused the tree to hit my house. On the other hand, there's a question behind that question, which I call, you know, causes behind causes. There's a higher order question involved, which is, why did that tree fall on my house? And not, by extension, someone else's house. And I think that in moments when multiple misfortunes befall people in cultures that have witchcraft as a kind of idiom for working through social conflict, I think that multiple misfortunes can produce the feeling, or can produce the anxiety, that someone is behind my misfortunes. Maybe someone is conspiring against me. Who is it? And I think that this is what happened after the war, where many people had experienced multiple misfortunes. Does that make sense?
It does. But isn't it interesting that it's almost like here, Germany is behind this atrocity, this massive atrocity, destruction of human will, spirit, and life. And then when it's over, it kind of is like the ebb and flow of the ocean. Now the tsunami that they started is coming back at them. And the paranoia, the delusions, the fear that they've struck into the hearts of the world is now almost repercussively attacking them and creating this metaphysical disturbance, if you will.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And I would say it very similarly, actually. I think that I also think it's important to think about the fact that, you know, you said you use the word paranoia, and I think that's exactly the right way to think about this. I think that, you know, Germany had been steeped in a kind of culture of paranoia for decades by 1950. I mean, there was the sense that a lot of people were deeply, profoundly confused about the fact that Germany had lost the First World War, and they invented an answer for why that had happened, which was this, you know, there's this famous myth that some of the military leaders of Germany had invented after the war to explain why Germany lost the First World War. And it's called the stab in the back legend. That's the way historians refer to it. Essentially, what the military leaders of the First World War said was that Germany had not lost the war. What lost the war was the revolution that takes place in 1918, which they said had so distracted the military and challenged the country that the prosecution of the war couldn't go forward and the war had to end in this very ignominious fashion. And Germany ends up taking, of course, because of the terms of the Versailles Treaty, Germany ends up taking all responsibility for that war. But this, the sense that somehow the country had been betrayed and betrayed from within, I think is a very important theme of German history from the First World War until the 1950s. And then I think it ends in the 1960s. But that sense that the country had been betrayed, that there were enemies within the country that had betrayed it. And I mean, I think that contributed, I think a lot of historians would agree that that contributed significantly to the rise of a figure like Hitler, who spoke to these grievances. He spoke to people's paranoias that there were people among us. There are people among us who wish us harm. Right. So that kind of language and that way of thinking about things, this very Manichaean black and white way of thinking about things, of enemies and allies, was one that had already pre-existed the period that I'm describing. But it is very fascinating, as you say, that it's in the wake of a second lost war when the Allies did not give Germany a chance after the Second World War to invent a myth like the stab in the back legend. They didn't give them that opportunity for a reason, because they saw how destructive allowing that kind of mythology could be for the country. And they wanted Germans to face what had actually happened. But then in this other way that I describe, and I think this goes back to something you were asking earlier, in this kind of sublimated way, these grievances continue to sort of spill over or percolate up into grassroots daily life.
If we could examine prior to World War II, even World War I, World War II, and leading up to the post wartime era, how important was the supernatural to Germany at that point? I mean, was it something that, obviously you watch the Indiana Jones movies and it is certainly a big MacGuffin for them, throughout the entire story to try to find these pieces that might give them some ludicrous leg up on the rest of the world. Was that a real part of their culture and belief system?
Well, so I have a friend actually named Eric Courlander, a colleague who wrote a really amazing book a few years ago called Hitler's Monsters. And I don't know if you have run across this book, but
I believe we have.
Yeah, you have. Okay, good. I think Eric shows in amazing, exhaustive detail that the leadership, not all individual leaders of the Third Reich, but many of the individual leaders of the Third Reich were enthralled by the supernatural, were enthralled by the idea that Germany could gain occult power. Himmler was, the sort of leading figure in that sort of line of thinking, but there were other people too. So I think that one part of the answer to your question is, yes, the Nazi hierarchy, many individuals involved in it were in fact very fascinated by the supernatural. That I think is clearly documented, voluminously documented by my friend Eric. But I would say there's another piece of this story, which is about, or there are a couple other pieces at least. Another piece of the story is about, just sort of ordinary people like me, and what we, what people in daily life believed or were fascinated by. And there was a strong fascination in Germany with the supernatural. There was a strong fascination with the paranormal. And that too is quite well documented. There's work has been done on those kinds of beliefs and practices and the fascination around them for, at least the first half of the 20th century. But another piece of this, I would say, just as a kind of as an extra piece to sort of add to the mix. I mean, fascination with the paranormal was not just a German thing,
Right.
Right. You know this. I mean that armies were doing research on all kinds of paranormal phenomena and things like that. So I would say in answer to your question, I think yes, on the one hand, certainly. And people were very interested in the supernatural in Germany. There's a real cultural thread of that that's easily documentable. And then, but also, you know, that again, that it wasn't unique. It wasn't entirely unique to them.
Right. It just, you know, to see this kind of spill out, obviously, after wartime, you see a rise in spiritualism around the world because people have lost their loved ones. They're seeking answers as to how these kind of atrocities can happen. They're reaching out to church or any organization that might give them some unfiltered, perception into what comes next. Where are our loved ones? Why do we pay these prices? And we've seen that in America quite often, these cyclical versions. That's, you know, we talk about on this show that kind of the kickoff of the popularity of the paranormal and how big it is in the United States again, I think you could trace it back to 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. Suddenly our country is thrown into this uncertainty. There are these deaths that are shocking and horrifying and people seeking answers. Yeah. And that's just kind of been the way we work. And now that it's out of the closet in the 21st century, there doesn't seem to be any putting it back in. It's out. It's, people are fascinated by every aspect of it now that they can talk about it without hushed tones, you know, in secret societies only. You can discuss this at work. It certainly has become a much more popularized thing.
It's interesting, too, that if I could just say quickly that, please. I mean, I think one of the things that you're hitting on, and it's something that I try to emphasize in the book, the idea, you know, a lot of people are very surprised by this and they're just amazed. And they say to me, wow, I can't believe these things that you unearthed. And I think, well, I think there's this interesting sort of naivete that people have about the existence of certain kinds of beliefs. I think what you're saying, and I agree with you if I've understood you correctly, is that these beliefs are very much a part of modern life. I think a lot of people have the idea that sort of the kinds of beliefs that we're sort of talking about are something that belong to the past, but not the present. But they very much belong to the present, as I think you were suggesting.
Right. It just, I think it belongs throughout time. We just have always seen these aspects of human nature, people trying to connect with those we've lost and understand why horrific things happen. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, again, you're coming off a country that was spearheading one of the world's largest wars and tragedies that crossed many different barriers, religion, color, race, you name it. And so many people were affected by this. As the war comes to an end and you start to have these aspects of the supernatural rise, as you said, the concepts of witchcraft, did it peak or get as fervored as it would, say, here in Salem, Massachusetts in the 1600s? Or was it handled differently?
It was handled extremely differently, and that's a very interesting question. So, what I describe in the book are a series of what at the time in German newspapers, magazines, and in other similar, you know, forms of media and other forums were described as witch trials. Were not witch trials in the sense that we think of when we think of the 16th or 17th century. So, those earlier witch trials. The witch hunt, that was a phenomenon of what, you know, historians call the early modern period. They were usually juridically or clerically led investigations to determine whether or not so-and-so was a witch and what was to be done about it. And as you know, those trials, not infrequently ended in executions. That is not at all what happened in post-war Germany. What happened in post-war Germany was much more, as I describe it in the book, pedestrian than that. In other words, people would accuse their neighbor, let's say, of being a witch, and the word would start to get around that so-and-so is a witch. And this was not an insignificant thing by any means for the person who was accused, because it had tremendous social repercussions. It was an awful thing to be accused of being a witch or to be rumored to be a witch or to be in league with evil, to be in league with the devil. And it resulted in, I mean, one of the cases that I describe in the book is about a woman who was accused or learned that she had been accused, and she became quite ill. She took to bed. She lost weight. She felt like her friends had abandoned her. Her family's business, they had a small business, was endangered by these accusations. So it's not that the quote unquote witch trials of the 1950s don't have social repercussions, because they do. The accusations themselves were quite harmful, but the era of the wide scale witch hunt that involves, you know, that sweeps up people in dangerous ways that can lead to them being executed as witches, that does not happen. What does happen sometimes, which is fascinating, I think, in this more recent variant, is that people who were accused sometimes, like the lady I just described, take to their beds and become withdrawn. In other cases, they take people to court, and that's what the witch trials were. They were instances where someone had been accused and said, well, to heck with that. I'm not going to be accused by this person of something I've certainly not done. And so they take them to court. Usually they take them to court for something like defamation. So they say, you know, this person is spreading awful rumors about me and ruining my reputation. And in one case that I describe in the book, for example, a woman who's been accused by a man of being a witch, the man ends up doing a short jail term. So the shoe is definitely on the other foot by the 1950s, where the accuser is the one who runs afoul of the law. But the
onus is finally put on the people that are making these statements, as opposed to the people that are victimized by being called a witch. I'm glad that that aspect of it at least changed.
Right. Yes, exactly. That aspect definitely changes.
All right. Now, the concept of witches and witchcraft itself, I mean, is that a pretty steeped in history legend of Germany? I'm not real familiar with witchcraft lore there. Obviously, it was part of European culture in England and such, and made its way over here, to the Americas. But what was the history of Germany with witches?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, historians of witchcraft would say that the Central Europe, that the German-speaking lands of Central Europe, not just the German-speaking lands, but the lands of Central Europe, today's Germany, Austria, Switzerland, the Netherlands, were the hotbed of witch persecution in the 16th and 17th century. So it was very much a the earlier history is one in which Germany plays a significant role, or the German lands play a significant role.
And looking at the other aspects, what other elements of the supernatural began their rise in Germany after the war, or at least certainly became much more popularized or scrutinized? We'll talk about that and more. Stay tuned. And remember, you can get a link to the book, A Demon Haunted Land, on today's program. So pick it up for yourself, rate and review it once you've read it, so that it helps out our authors as well. Stay tuned. We've got more coming your way. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave. That's Tim. This is Darkness Radio. We are back. Our guest, Monica Black, the book, A Demon Haunted Land. Obviously, you say supernatural, paranormal, people start thinking of elements of darkness. We talked a little bit about the witch, you know, witch trials, or the witch accusations that were being slung around. Was it all dark and spooky concepts of supernatural that was going on in post-war Germany, or were there different elements of it as well?
So that's an interesting question. So I would say that one of the things that I was particularly fascinated by, so on the one hand, I would say, no, there are other elements too, certainly. But what I focused on in the book were various ways that various kinds of what I think of as supernatural episodes that seem to be peculiarly focused on evil. In other words, I kind of looked at a variety of different kinds of sources, and I looked at a variety of different kinds of stories that I unearthed about this period. And one of the things that really struck me was the obsession with many people, the obsession of many people with evil. I mean, I think on the one hand, there was a sense of a kind of cosmic war, you know, that there was a sense among some people that the war itself had been a kind of, we wouldn't think about it this way, but in some Germans' minds, they were fighting a war against evil. They were fighting a war against their Bolshevik enemies, and they were fighting a war against, as they saw it, the Jewish people, who they regarded as their inveterate enemy. I was very fascinated by how that kind of, how after the war, this obsession with evil continues, but it now has different objects. So to answer your question, I really was more interested in these darker phenomena, but I will say this, and maybe this gives a little bit of a flavor of other aspects of the book, although I think they're also rather dark. It depends on how you think about it. I mean, part of the subtitle of the book has the term wonder doctors in it. Wonder doctors were, that's just sort of a direct translation of the German, people who were, these were figures who were essentially folk healers or lay healers or faith healers, we might call them in the American context, although in the case of the people that I looked at, they weren't really evangelists. I think in the United States context, in American cultural history, we would think about faith healers as people who are, are somehow connected with evangelism. And these, the folks that I wrote about were not. The main character that I focus on is, the main healer that I focus on is a man named Bruno Gröning. And Bruno Gröning did not preach. He just seemed to embody this energy that cured people of things. And he became a very, very much a celebrity in the early post-war period, touring the country and to, you know, huge crowds and curing people of all sorts of things. So
let's dive into that. I mean, again, is this a curative healing that he's really doing? Is it a placebo effect of just, you know, having somebody care in that moment and offer something and giving a sign of hope again to people that maybe had lost hope? Or, how do we explain what this man was truly capable of, and what is fact from fiction in his story?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, that's a very difficult thing to really nail down in some ways. I would say that for myself as a historian, because, you know, I'm very much a kind of anthropologically minded historian. And if somebody tells me that they were healed of something, then I take that seriously in the sense that I think that that tells me something about the moment in which they're living, and it tells me something about their experience. In other words, I don't try to sort of impose my own explanation of what happened onto them. I just try to listen to what it is that they're telling me about what happened to them. So what I would say is that one of the things that's really interesting about this period, and you're exactly right about, I think, about trust and hope, and this is why I think that this phenomenon of the healers can actually be viewed in more than one way. I do think that this was a period in which people had lost tremendously, were experiencing tremendous loss, not least of which was their loss of faith and trust in institutions, their loss of faith and trust in each other. They were experiencing a kind of, as I describe it in the book, spiritual malaise, and a sense of hopelessness. And I do think that figures like Bruno Gröning, this healer that I was talking about a moment ago, did provide a kind of they did provide a form of solace. I would also say, though, that if people came to Bruno Gröning using crutches or came to Bruno Gröning using a wheelchair and said that they suddenly had lost the ability to walk, which happened a lot, actually, around him. There were people who had just suddenly, after the war, lost the ability to walk. They had suddenly lost the ability to see. They had suddenly lost the ability to hear. This happened over and over again. And he was able, through whatever means, to help people who had not been able to walk again. And this is, you know, there are many, 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 many references to such situations in the archival sources that I looked at. So a very profoundly skeptical person might say, well, that was, maybe you mentioned a moment ago, I think you did, the placebo effect or something like that. Maybe there's just some salutary effect from, you know, they weren't really sick in the first place and he isn't really curing them. But what I would say actually is that we have to think about what people were sick from, right? So it's not just illness, it seems to me. The word, if you think about the word disease, right, it's composed of two particles, dis and ease.
Right.
Disease is not just a biological fact, and it's not just like coronavirus, right? People get a bug and then they become ill in many cases. Sickness is also spiritual and moral. And I think that the question is not, for me, the question was not so much, was he able to cure them? And if so, how? It was more, what exactly was he curing them of? That's the way I sort of framed it in the book. So,
and what are your takeaways? I mean, there are healers out there that had plants. They had people that would walk up on crutches and then walk away or dance away, you know, being healed in these instances. How far along did some of these people that were healed get followed? Do we know, was this a legitimate aspect of this man's abilities?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, he has followers even now. I mean, one of the things that really struck me, and I until you just asked that question, I had sort of forgotten this, but I'm glad that you reminded me. So when I first started doing the research for this book, I found that this man has, you know, there are websites and in dozens of languages about him throughout the world. So somehow his sort of the work that he did, let's say, as a healer in the 1950s, spread out through the work, I think, of his followers. And he continues to have a kind of following, even though he's been dead since the late 1950s. He continues to have a following of a size that I can't quite determine. But one of the things, this is what I was going to say a moment ago, what I'd forgotten about. When I was first doing the research, a friend of mine who gets treated by a local massage therapist who also does other forms of healing, who also, you know, has, and I don't actually know what the names of these forms of healing are, but my friend said, you know, I was in the office of the lady that I go to for my whatever it was, and I can't remember, back trouble or something. And she said, and there were cards from the guy that you're writing about. So somehow this man's fame extends even to now, to the extent that locally here in my own town in Knoxville, Tennessee, you can find, people distributing his cards. And in the city of Asheville, North Carolina, which is, you know, about 2 hours to the west of where I live, I just saw on the internet not that long ago that someone was giving a discussion, was hosting a discussion about Bruno Gröning. So in other words, I'm not sure I'm exactly answering your question, but what I'm saying is that he, for the people with whom he worked, he is absolutely revered as a healer, even to this day.
That's pretty impressive, right? I mean, it wasn't something that just scaled back, but, you know, I mean, you've got people that are followers of Nostradamus, even though there's a considerable amount of information that shows that, you know, his quatrains and his predictions could be easily manipulated to be looked at in many different forms, but he still has followers and believers. Edgar Cayce, kind of the same thing, right? The sleeping prophet. You've got somebody who's just come out of nowhere with this ability. Did what do we know about his past, and when did this ability of his healing properties take effect?
Yeah, so interesting to think about that. So he was from the city of Danzig, which is today's Gdansk in Poland on the Baltic Sea. And he was born, I want to say, in 1906. I may be getting that slightly wrong, but let's just say within the first decade of the 20th century. He grew up in the shadow of the First World War, which was very difficult in Germany. You know, there was a blockade for a lot of the war, and food was very hard to come by. And he grew up in that time. And then as an adult, and I can't remember exactly off the top of my head now when he began to have his first sort of experiences with healing people, but he seems to have been sort of identified by a local healer, a woman, who thought that he had something, that he had some kind of ability. And there are stories about him from when he was a child that he would go, or as a young, let's say as a young adolescent person, that he would go into the woods by himself, and he would stay there for a very long time. And he had a kind of, it was said that he had a very unique relationship to nature. Well, fast forward a little way. The Second World War begins. Actually, before that, I should also say that Bruno Gröning was a member of the Nazi Party. He became a Nazi in the early 1930s. Fast forward a little bit further, the Second World War begins, Germany invades Poland, Danzig eventually becomes part of the expanding German Reich, of the era of the Second World War. After the war, he is a refugee. He's actually a POW for a period of time. He's captured by the Soviets, and he's taken to a POW camp. And he's there for a few months before being released. And at that point, he immigrates to Western Germany, which was not yet at that point West Germany. It was just the Western part of Germany, still under Allied occupation. And he is, he's one of these, there were millions and millions of ethnic Germans who were expelled from territories in Eastern Europe after the Second World War. And he's one of those people. So that's how he becomes a refugee. He winds up in the west of Germany. And the story that's told is that the story that he, not know that he told it himself, but that people told of him at the time, was that he had cured a lady in this town he was living in of something. And I don't exactly know what that was. And someone heard about this. And this man who heard the story of this amazing healing had a grandson, and the grandson's name was Dieter. And he said, the grandfather of Dieter said to Dieter's parents, he said, "I heard about this guy who's a healer, who's just had some kind of success curing a lady. Why don't we ask him to come here and see if he can help Dieter?" Now, Dieter had some kind of muscular disorder that was that had made him progressively over the course of his very young life less and less able to walk, less and less able to get around on his own. And so they called Gröning. Gröning came. And the story was that within a few days of being in Gröning's company, that this child, Dieter, was walking by himself, was going into the yard to play, and had become ambulatory. And he had not been able to do that for a while, according to his parents. As news of this cure, or what appeared temporarily, at least in this case, to be a cure, got around, people began to flock to the small town where this family lived, where Dieter's family lived, in huge numbers. Thousands of people started pouring into this little town, which is called Hereford. And not long after that, There were various, local politicians, local leaders did what they could to try to stop him from healing, stop him from having these public gatherings where people were coming to him for cures. So he just left and went somewhere else. And he kind of moved around that way for a period of time. Finally, he was essentially stopped by legal action from continuing his work. He still continued it, but he did it in a very different way, I would say. Rather than having large crowds meeting with him who drew an enormous amount of attention, he would meet with smaller groups of people. And he continued to do that throughout the 1950s and up to his death. Sorry, that was a really long answer.
No, it's great. I love that it's informative and not just a quick glossary of it. So he did continue, and people continued to look at him as this remarkable healer. That's fascinating. And to see where he came from as a Nazi, as somebody a part of that war machine, to a healer. The other aspect of that gift unveiled or revealed, you would think almost that the German people would have taken to that and taken this light being, this healer, and have kind of stood behind him in, you know, juxtaposition to where they had just come from, and trying to show and put forth a better light and a better figure that people could think of when they consider Germany.
Well, he was I understand exactly what you're saying, but I would say about Bruno Gröning that he was a very complicated figure. And I think that's why actually he's a very interesting person to read about. He was very interesting for me to read about. And he was very interesting for me to try to understand. I mean, part of what's so complex about him is I don't associate people who have a spiritual gift with Nazism. So when I found out that Bruno Gröning had been a Nazi, I was amazed by this. And I wondered exactly how does that fit into my own picture of what a spiritual healer should, quote unquote, look like. But I would also say that after the war, he had a very, he had a pretty complicated sort of run. I mean, he, on the one hand, he really seems to have been a kind of spiritual source for a lot of people. On the other hand, he really liked to drink and carouse. He, by many accounts, was quite a womanizer. And then at the end of his life, the last sort of act of his life is that he's put on trial for. He was put on trial. The allegation was that he had convinced a young woman who had tuberculosis to stop medical treatment, and she had done that. Now, he contested that and said that he had not told her to stop medical treatment, and I think the record is actually fairly complicated, too, about that story. That's a very complicated story. What happens is that he's convicted, and he dies right before sentencing is going to be passed. So in other words, what I'm saying is he, on the one hand, had these qualities that attracted people to him. People said that they could trust him. They felt that he was someone that they could talk to when they didn't have anyone else to talk to. On the other hand, he seems to have been had some pretty roguish qualities. So, and worse than roguish qualities, I mean, he had been a member of the Nazi Party. So I think in a way, the complexity of his character is the complexity of this period.
Let's take it, as long as we're kind of on this more cathartic aspect of a healer. What about the visages of the Virgin Mary suddenly mysteriously making these appearances? How often was this, and to what level was it recognized as being the Virgin Mary? Meaning, was it just, hey, look at that oil stain on the wall, kind of looks like the Virgin Mary, and 20 guys take a picture and post it on social media kind of vibe? Or was this like Medjugorje Fatima, where people start coming in droves to examine this visitation?
Yes, so it's a great question. So the first part of the answer is that there were many, 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 many sightings of the Virgin Mary in post-war Germany. I have another friend of mine, Michael O'Sullivan, has written, just published a really great book about that, subject. And the sightings, some of them, I mean, as Michael describes in his book, some of these sightings drew in, you know, a few dozen people. Some of them drew in, it's said that the most famous of the post-war sightings of the Virgin Mary, which took place in a village in Bavaria called Haraldsbach, that sighting drew in some 1.5 million pilgrims. So there's a big range. And I would say that most, the question that you're asking about sort of acceptance or the general sort of the sense that the apparitions were legitimate or not was also complicated. The church itself denied the legitimacy of the apparitions at Haraldsbach, for example. And in fact, there's a story about how, you know, the seers, the original seers, who were a group of little girls, it was very much like the Fatima story, actually, that the little girls, some of them at least ended up being excommunicated for continuing to talk about the apparitions, for continuing to sort of help to build the legend of the apparitions. And some local clergy too were replaced from their, you know, were taken out of their jobs and moved somewhere else. So the church did not accept the legitimacy of these apparitions. But
that's weird.
Yeah.
Why? Do we have any insight as to why they would denounce that?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting history too. I mean, since the 19th century, the church has very actively, tried to determine the reality of various apparitions. And there have been probably many more apparitions that the church does not consider legitimate than ones that it does. So, yeah, I mean, I think in this case, it's actually not that surprising. The church goes through a rigorous procedure to try to understand. So on the one hand, Lourdes, the most famous example, is accepted by the Catholic Church as having been a legitimate site of the Visitation of the Virgin Mary. But Haraldsbach, this place I was talking about, is not. And there's more Haraldsbachs out there than Lourdes, to be sure.
Do you think that there was an aspect to it as well of, you know, we just came out of a pretty dark part of our history, maybe we shouldn't be claiming, oh, look, the Virgin Mary is appearing to us, as though giving credence or like we are a blessed land or something? And do you think there was a public relations aspect to denouncing it and or burying the story?
That's a very interesting question. I would say that one of the things that I argue in the book is that the apparitions that happen in the 50s or the late 1940s and early 50s are more about people atoning than they are about trying to claim some kind of blessedness. So I think your question is really interesting. It seems to me that in a lot of the cases that I looked at, people were demanding that other, you know, demanding that their fellow Germans atone. It's not always clear what exactly they want each other to atone for. That part is often left unsaid. Although sometimes even that breaks into the open. When people were arguing about the validity of the apparitions at Haraldsbach, there were open accusations that, you know, by some of the believers that the clergy had been too cozy with the Nazi regime. So I think it's actually, like everything in post-war Germany, is extremely morally complicated scene.
Yeah, just I could only guess, right? And a lot of people don't realize, you know, just because if it really was the Virgin Mary, people might question why over Germany, why in this land that just created so much havoc for the rest of the world. Well, religiously speaking, you could say because these people were also reduced to rubble. Their lives were kind of ground down. And, you know, why wouldn't something, a figure of faith appear to them to try to turn things around? to try to show them a better path and a light.
Yeah, it's very complicated. I think as you're trying to describe it, I feel the same way. It's a very difficult thing to sort of wrap your mind around.
The bad guys to be punished. We want the bad guys to be locked up, their lives in ruin, and not think that something glorious might appear to them. But, you know, I mean, even when Christ was up on the cross talking to the criminals next to him, they asked for forgiveness. And, you know, even in those moments, there's a time to connect with people that have been lost. So I can understand the religious aspect of it, but it is just a weird, just a strange story overall. Do we know much about the supernatural element of hauntings during that time? Was there any kind of moral flashback of spirits because of the amount of death and trauma that took place there that were being witnessed?
Yeah. So I wrote something about this, actually, about post-war ghosts once. And the ghosts in this book are a little bit different. I sort of used haunting as a kind of metaphor for understanding the sense, as I was saying earlier, of spiritual malaise that so many people experienced after the war, the sense of that they were being dogged by something, that there was something gnawing at them, there was something behind them over their shoulder. And so there's, I think about, and I describe in the book two different kinds of hauntings of this kind. And one is a sort of individual level haunting where people felt, you know, as I said, a sense of just profound unease. And that sometimes, in my estimation, translated itself into people becoming physically ill. And those are some of the people that I think went to visit Bruno Gröning. And then there's another kind of haunting that I describe, which is a kind of a feeling of unease that spreads out over whole communities. And that is the kind of haunting that I describe when I talk about witchcraft. But as far as ghosts go, you know, people seeing ghosts, I mean, it's actually quite fascinating to me that the kind of ghost culture that you see after the First World War, as you were talking about earlier with spiritualism, you don't really see that, at least not in the German context. There may be other national contexts where you see it, but not in the context that I am most familiar with.
All right. Yeah, I was just curious. I mean, obviously in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there were quite a few tales of spiritual awakenings, ghosts, and things that were seen and are still seen today. I didn't know if there was any of that that was spoken about, or at least openly, in Germany. Or again, was that something that part of the propaganda machine would have buried because they wouldn't want their people being afraid that they're being haunted by the ghosts of the atrocities that have taken place?
Right. So
I know that's a speculative question. I'm just, you know, it's just one of those things that makes you scratch your head and wonder.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's a very, I think all of these issues in some ways relate back to something that you said earlier, which is about the questions that people have. People have questions that cannot be answered. And I don't think I think that there are ways in which people find answers. What am I trying to say? I think that there are some questions that we cannot know the answer to. Right. And that drives a certain desire to find answers. And I think a lot of the things that we're talking about are a part of that quest for some kind of clarity, some kind of insight.
There were large prayer groups that would come together to perform exorcisms. Talk to me a little bit about that, if you would. Give us some insight into that. Again, that's something fascinating. What drove that, and why was there a sense of possession taking place? What was behind that socio kind of concept?
Yeah, no, that's right. So there were, I found evidence of some prayer groups that organized to cast out demons from people's bodies. It's one of these, it's linked to this story about a kind of obsession with evil after the war and trying to locate evil, and sometimes people locating evil within themselves, which I take to be evidence of a kind of spiritual reckoning. Not a complete spiritual reckoning, but a kind of an attempt to grapple with what had just happened and who was responsible for it. And I think that, you know, one of the group that I describe in Munich was a group of maybe 15 or 20 people who the police were called to the house because people were praying so loudly that it kind of alarmed the neighbors. And some of these people were then asked to come to the police station to describe what was going on there so the police could determine whether or not they needed to intervene further. And as it turned out, the people who were involved described that they were helping each other, that they were trying to help each other be free of their demons, be free of the you know, the spiritual pressure that they were under. So I just
Could you imagine living in this country where you've got this leader that was so hypnotic, so charismatic that people would do anything for him, and then to have the hindsight, the breath between the end of the war and the 1950s to look back at these atrocities and realize how you were a part of them, even though you may not have pulled the trigger, you may not have turned anyone in or been a part of it, just to know that you've got a question, especially, I mean, those were good religious people, right, in their concept. And all of a sudden, they're part of something that took many lives. How do you start to rectify those feelings? And, you know, purging the psychological aspect psychological is one aspect of it, but that need and want to just give back that and again, appropriate it onto something that is not a part of me. I was obviously under the influence of darkness and obviously under the influence of this, and that can be the only explanation for why we allowed this to happen. And, you know, was it more of a cathartic nature, more of a, you know, going through the motions as opposed to it legitimately people believing that they were under oppression or possession by demonic forces?
My reading of it is the latter, that people were felt spiritually plagued somehow, that they felt somehow that they were living under some kind of cloud. Now, the nature of this cloud could actually be a number of different things if you think about it. So on the one hand, the thing that we would tend to think of most readily, of course, is the events that culminate in the Holocaust and the persecution of Jews throughout Europe, and that leads to the Holocaust, that leads to genocide. But there were other things that I think people felt spiritually plagued about too. Like, for example, if you are a religious person and you lose a war of such scale, or of any scale really, how do you explain that to yourself? I mean, one way that you might explain it to yourself is to say, we weren't favored by God. And then once you've said that to yourself, we weren't favored by God, you have to start asking yourself why, right? So I think, again, it goes back to this issue of questions, the questions that people ask, existential questions that cannot be answered, but that weigh on people with tremendous heaviness. And so I don't think it was so much that people were avoiding, I can see that as a reading, that people were avoiding somehow coming to terms with or confronting their own responsibility, their own sense of their own complicity, their sense of their own role in what had happened. I don't think it's quite that. I think it has more to do with the sense that one is plagued by a sense of doubt, a tremendous, profound sense of doubt about what it all means. What does it mean that we lost the war? Does it mean we're being punished? Does it mean that God has turned his back on us? That's what I think. That's my reading of those phenomena in the book.
wrapping up, I mean, in examining this, putting it together, was much of this content a surprise to you? Or do you see that this is really kind of an aspect of most of the world in and out of wartime and the cyclical nature of history and our fascination with things outside of our influence?
Yeah, yeah, that's such a good question. So I was totally 100% surprised. I was blown away from the moment that I found the book that I started out talking, you know, at the beginning of our conversation, the book that I learned about, Are There Witches Among Us, to my discovery of Bruno Gröning, to my discovery in the archives of these prayer groups, and learning about the apparitions of the Virgin Mary. Every one of these things surprised me because my image of Germany, post-war Germany, has been, and I think it's for a lot of people, that Germany's post-war history is a success story, that Germany had committed, you know, as a nation, tremendous acts of violence, had unleashed chaos on the world, had committed genocide, and yet became an exemplary democracy in a very short time. And I believe that story, right? And of course, that story is true. That is a true story. But what I'm trying to say here is that there's another story, a shadow history that has not been revealed. And so my job was to sort of try to reveal it.
And you've done a fantastic job in doing that. And I know our listeners particularly will find this fascinating. But so well, you know, my son, who loves history, if I've got a book I'm compelled to give him about UFOs during wartime, he may not buy into the concept of UFOs, but he's interested in history and an element of the story or why people might have believed those things existed at that time. And that seems like a perfect kind of reader for your book as well. People that may not buy into the supernatural elements themselves, but buy into why do people believe these things? And that is an interesting underlying thread throughout your entire book, is bringing people to that point where they can see for themselves and judge. You know, you're not pushing an agenda one way or the other. You're simply reporting on a part of history, as you said, that was kind of a shadowy aspect.
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly, I appreciate you saying that. That's certainly what I tried to do. I wanted to write a history of post-war Germany that showed that we have to include these aspects of post-war German history in a larger story about Reconstruction and the development of democracy and the development of democratic institutions. All those things are true. And yet there are other things to know. There are things to know about psychology. There are things to know about the spiritual aspects of how people grappled with the loss of the war, how they grappled with their responsibility for genocide. Those things are a part of that story too. I think there's a sort of sense of, you know, that history can only involve certain kinds of information or something like that. And I have resisted that belief my entire career. So, yeah.
Well, thank you. It's a fascinating read. I think, again, people are going to like this from all different aspects. I've said, if we can find ways to tie history into other compelling storytelling techniques, people that may have strayed away from it or have become bored with it, or kids, you know, people in general like that, might be more interested in hearing this when you can give them tastes of history with strange mysteries surrounding them and aspects of supernatural elements. I think people would be more than willing to go along on that ride because it's something more than what they've been spoon-fed in the past.
I hope that you're right, and I think that you are right, and I think that I'd like to continue to work toward that goal. I want people to be interested in history. I mean, it's my passion, and it's what I've done. You know, it's what I've spent my life doing. So I hope that you're right. I think that you are.
Well, I hope so. After 15 years of doing this radio show, I think that's the path we're on.
Very good.
Demon Haunted Land, Witches, Wonder Doctors, and the Ghosts of the Past in Post-World War II Germany, Monica Black. It has been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your insights, interest, and these looks behind history into, in my opinion, very compelling aspects that have been overlooked and perhaps would have been lost to time if somebody like you hadn't uncovered them to share them again.
Thank you so much. It has been just a distinct pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all. This is the holiday season. I hope that you are all safe and happy, surrounded in love and laughter. And please, again, for our listeners out there that are maybe isolated, feeling alone at this time of year, please don't hesitate. Email me, dave@darknessradio.com. We have a great grouping of paranormal pen pals that like what you like. You're listening to the show, they listen to the show, and they are willing to communicate and help bring you up out of that loneliness and that dark cloud that you feel that you're under. This is no time for anybody to feel alone. So please embrace the season and the reason of the season and just write. We will find people, including myself, that'll write back and help to hold your hand through some of the more difficult times. It's a time for family, friendship, love, and laughter and light, and we hope that all of you are enjoying that today and for the rest of your lives. That's it for tonight. Thank you so much for tuning in to the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader, that cute little elf over there, that's Tim Dennis, and you've been listening to the Christmas edition of Darkness Radio.